The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
A lot of value or the profit that might conceivably come from this kind of process as well, as we look into why people tick the way they do. I think especially in our circles where we tend to be so message-oriented, part of developing a pastoral approach in Alenctics is to develop a sensitivity to just the way people function in a psychological way, and being able to appreciate what's going on in them and how can I communicate, you know, in terms of that whole process.
When you think about it, we sort of go through that same kind of process when we tend to analyze the biblical writers. We've got our psychology. We know what Moses was like based on some things, and a lot of times we let our imaginations run away with ourselves. We make all these statements about who Moses is, etc. If you want to pick on somebody that makes snap decisions, everybody thinks of Peter, etc., etc. We tend to do that anyway. So whether we like it or not, I guess we are structuralists to a certain extent when we read our Bible. We do kind of draw personality from between the lines and make those kind of impressions, so maybe it's not as
first. I heard Paul Smith from People's Church was preaching at a conference. I forget exactly what he was talking about. I think he was dealing with David when he was a young boy and how they came to him and said, "You're going to be king," and so forth. And he went into and he said, "Now I know it doesn't say that in the Bible, but use your imagination."
Structuralist, there you go.
And you know, that's what I, you know, what clicked in my mind. Use your imagination. He's psychologizing. You know, we can't do this, but we do.
Okay.
And I've done it.
Well, even then, I guess what I'd still hold out for, Tom, is that even when you're dealing with, say, the biblical documents, to some degree or other, you are psychologizing those biblical documents. You've got to, in order to understand nuances. I'm just immediately trying to think of a text where people struggle with those issues, but I can't right now. But anyway, you know, with a written document, looking for the psychological nuances is tougher, because all we have are, and particularly if it's a document that's got some age to it, all we have is something without the historical context, the cultural setting in which it was living. So we struggle even harder with how to understand those areas, and it becomes to that extent more difficult and dangerous. And I suspect that may be the reason in evangelical circles we tend to minimize or be more wary psychological interpretations of the text when we look at it. But on the other hand, when we're dealing with Alenctics and we're dealing with living people and with a living cultural system, to that extent, I think the usefulness of these psychological elements becomes even more keen. We're not dealing with words, we're dealing with people. And because we are dealing with people, we want to try as hard as we can to understand where those people are coming from. And that means not just understanding, they believe A about God, they believe B about Jesus, they believe C about the world, the evil spirits. But we try to find out, why have they put it together in this kind of construction? In a sense, we're sort of, I see it sort of looking like for felt needs, only in this case, we're looking for the psychological felt needs. Levi Strauss is helpful, may be helpful in terms of his helping us see the universals. But as you point out, one of the difficulties here is when you start doing that, you have multiplied your job immensely. And I think this is why presumably a lot of his critics are jumping on him and saying, look, you're giving us a job that's impossible to do. But on the other hand, it may be no more impossible than spending your lifetime studying, you know, the cultural habits, cultural attitudes towards sacred trees of the Ndembu as over against 4,000 other cultures. So, you just have to count on those who can do the work for us with the hope that the risks they take can be, we can appropriate and use with sensitivity for our evangelistic work in working with people.
Is this being taught as a method, the structuralism?
Oh, yes, yeah.
People actually practice on literature and they learn to be
right.
Discerning with different forms.
Right, right.
That's like the old form criticism.
Well, it is, it's pointed out to Ian in theology as sort of it's one step further than the old form criticism. There is a book, a simple book published by Fortress Press, if some of you are interested in this, and it's called simply What is Structural Exegesis? And it's written, I think, by Norman Perrin, the New Testament scholar. That is probably the best simple introduction to structuralism in matters of biblical exegesis I know of. And it has a few things on Levi Strauss, so it might be helpful to you here. But as I said, I don't know of any evangelical missiologists or evangelical anthropologists who've even begun to try and make use of Levi Strauss. In the latest issue of Missiology magazine, there is an essay by an Armenian scholar on contextualization, sort of summarizing the discussion. And in it, he's just got his doctorate from Fuller Seminary, and his doctoral dissertation he just refers to in a footnote, but it was on Levi Strauss and missiological anthropology. So that he may be one of the first to finally begin breaking through the barriers, but nothing has been published, but I'm sure it's coming. It's hit us in every other area of theology. It's bound to hit us in missions.
Can we assume he's a Jew? Carrying Levi? Some form of Levi? Maybe.
I really can't say. Probably the standard work on his both his history, his life and work is by that same title, Claude Lévi-Strauss, written by Edmund Leach, L-E-A-C-H. We have that in the library. You'll find a lot of his stuff at the seminary library. But if you're interested in poking into it further, it'll just sort of get you ready. The next set of definitions I wanted to... I'll just give you the heading. We'll take our break now. And let's see, this was two. Three would be functionalist definitions. And I think this is very important for us because this is when we get into a lot of contemporary writers in missions like Charles Craft, McGavern, and others. They're very indebted to the functionalist definitions of religion. I'm using the term that's... one of the big phrases or terms in anthropology, one of the big movements, is called functionalism. It originated in the 1920s, and it is usually associated with two very big names in anthropology. Neither of these are Christians. One is Bronislaw Malinowski. Let's see, his dates are 1884 to 1942. He has a little book called Magic, Science, and Religion. You can still pick it up in paperback. Have you studied that, David?
Yeah.
And the other one is a Britisher by the name of Radcliffe Brown, A.R. Radcliffe Brown. His dates, 1881, 1955.
What were the other guys' dates?
1884 to 1942. And this will be the last set of definitions I want to give you, then we're going to deal with Bovink and what I would call the covenant concept of religion. Functionalism sort of retains from the past of anthropology a very deep sense of religion as flowing from man's emotional character. That's sort of Freud stuff. Only, unlike Freud, it does not look on religion as a disease of culture. Further, it rejects the evolutionary framework of sort of, you know, the progress of religion that was characteristic of earlier work.
Is he saying religion flows from man's culture?
Yeah, they'll say that, right. Or it's well, no, not quite that right. Hang on just a sec. No, what I wanted to say is it flows from man's emotional character. Now, at the same time, I should say, I tried to minimize the evolutionary hypothesis. When you read a functionalist like Malinowski or these people, it's not that they're not evolutionists. It's sort of more like they put evolution off on the shelf and said it's really not important. Or they've said, we don't have enough data to prove this one way or the other. So since we don't have the data, let's put the thesis off on the shelf. And so under one of the big effects, really a big effect of the functionalist in anthropology, rejected the armchair way of study. It was, this old armchair way I mentioned, whereby you sort of create hypotheses, you spin off hypotheses to explain things, and then you look for facts to back them up. All of this was discarded, and what came to the attention, sort of the forefront of anthropology, was this idea of field gathering of data, field work. You know, now we're so used to that kind of stuff that it doesn't seem like it's very revolutionary at all. But it was when it was proposed. You know, if you really want to find out information about the Australian Aborigines, you know, you don't sit down in front of your television set waiting for the latest Australian movie. The best thing you ought to do is go and live with the Australian Aborigines for 2 years. You know, boy, that's a brand new idea. And it really was. But it came out of this functionalist kind of idea. So that what happened then as a result of this functionalist thing was that the evolutionary questions kind of receded into the background. But at the same time, as I said, you'll still find that evolutionary questions have not been rejected. They're just there in the background, at least with respects to cultural anthropology. If you find yourself in the area of physical anthropology, boy, they'll be right in the forefront. Now, the one thing it shares with the evolutionary definition, I think, is its picture of religion as the satisfaction of human need, and human need of an emotional character. That's where the word functionalism comes from. In other words, its stress is on religion as a basic human need, alongside sex, hunger, the drive for shelter, for community and life, you know, all these basic drives. And the whole point of this is that human culture then is basically sort of a kind of a vast instrumental reality. That's, again, there's that word functionalism. It's a functional reality. Culture was created by human beings to fulfill certain basic human functions. In other words, to put it another way, this is Malinowski's language, culture is an instrument serving man's biological and psychological needs. And one of those needs is religion.
Can you repeat that?
So culture is an instrument to serve man's biological and psychological needs. For example, we mentioned Melanowski, and he wrote this classic little book called Magic, Science, and Religion, and you can still pick it up in a paperback bookstore. In that book, he's trying, you know, what's the difference between magic and science? What's the difference between magic, science, and religion? That's basically the questions he asks. Now, he lived among a group in the South Pacific called the Trobriand Islanders. And so he uses the Trobriand Islanders as his sort of case studies to deal with this question. For example, he notes, these Trobriand Islanders, here are all the anthropologists before him calling these kinds of people primitive, savage, barbaric, superstitious. But he says you couldn't take a bunch of armchair theoreticians out of Colombia, set them down in the middle of the South Pacific and have them make one of these balanced war canoes. He said, why, they would, or you couldn't even put them in it and send them out in the surf. They'd, they'd tip over within the first wave hit them. And yet he says, here are these primitive, crude, unsophisticated Trobriand Islanders, and they know how to build these lovely canoes, you know, with the outrigging thing. And they can float over huge waves, and they know just how to do the balance. They haven't studied any books on physics, but they know what balances and what doesn't. That's science. These are scientific people. He's trying to get away from this idea of looking at all these people as primitives, as it were. Okay, that's science. Well, he says, and yet at the same time, these people will go out, when they get in that outrigger canoe, and they're going to go out into the water. Just before they go out into the water, what do they do? They take wine, they pour it into the ocean. Or they'll take take a chicken, slice its throat, and then pour the blood into the ocean. And then they step into the outrigger canoes, and off they go. Now, what does that mean? What are these scientific people, capable of putting together, according to the most sophisticated laws of physics, a boat, pouring chicken blood into the ocean and wine into the water? Well, he says, because they recognize that there's an area of their life over which science cannot touch. There's an area of their life that they have to move beyond when they go beyond science. And that, says Melanowski, is the area of religion. And so magic is, as it were, the scientific tool that functions in the area of religion. That area that you know is beyond, the rules and the systems. Religion then flows from the nature of man as not as essentially rational, but as essentially emotional. Magic, he says, is founded on emotion. Science is founded on intellectual processes. Now, maybe if you studied with John Bettler or Jay Adams, and just to give you some sample where this works, in the area of psychology, if I remember right, there's another fellow called Maslow, and Maslow has talked about hierarchy of values. Is that it?
Needs. Five.
Hierarchy of needs. And there's five?
Five.
Do you remember what those are? One would be, the hunger.
Security, I think, is one.
Security.
Yeah.
I'm not putting these in order, but
I don't
security,
know
hunger.
The Phillies.
All right.
I can't think of the
right,
other.
But there are several. I think sex would be one.
Mm-hmm.
Another, but among the five, would be religion. Now, Melanowski says, yes, that's right. In the field of anthropology, there would be a lot of agreement between Maslow and Melanowski. Now, see, this makes these fellows different from Freud and all those other fellows. It's not that they're throwing religion out the window. They're not discarding it as unimportant in human cultures. They are recognizing it as an important element of human culture because it satisfies a specific felt need in a human being. And that felt need you'll find anywhere, whether it's a Trobriand Islander or whether it's some sophisticated New Yorker, you know, who treats his health club almost as his god, or a teenager, you know, who worships his Cadillac with the two mufflers. You know, it's the same kind of thing. But you know, it's one among many. That's the important element to it. So I guess what I want to say is, remember that religion in this whole system doesn't get pulled out. You know, it isn't. Religion in this whole system isn't at the top of the list. It isn't sort of the thing that puts it all together. It's just one among many. Now, I mention all this because the influence of functionalism on Christian anthropology, Christian formulations of anthropology, has been immense. Many of the people, the Christian anthropologists writing today, were trained under functionalists. Functionalism was the school of anthropology, and in many cases still has tremendous effect all the way through the 50s and 60s. And that's when these people were trained. It has an influence. For example, let's take Eugene Nida, whose books probably you've read. Eugene Nida, I think, modifies a lot of these things. Everybody will. There's no way you can just simply take functionalism as a Christian and just buy it. There are modifications. But for Nida, for example, he sees religion as one of man's basic human needs. It fulfills one of man's basic desires, the desire for communication, for meaning. And so in almost all of Nida's books, whenever he defines religion, he defines it as a process of communication. He has a book called Message and Mission. I think it was the second book he wrote. And the subtitle of the book is called The Communication of the Christian Faith. And he starts off by saying religion is just basically a means of communication. And I think some of that is coming from Maslow's forms. Now, religion then is one component. It is listed alongside of satisfaction of thirst, satisfaction of hunger, satisfaction of sex, satisfaction of belonging. He has another book that was written about 1960, which I think is really a good one, and you might want to look at it. Called Religion Across Cultures. It's published by Harper and Row. A lot of Nida's books have tremendous, you know, they're filled with illustrations from all these different cultures.
That was just revised, I think, in 1979, too. I think I just checked it out of Monterey.
Could be. Boy, I didn't know that. And this one minimizes the illustrations. But it begins with the whole question of what is religion. And I think the first chapter deals with that. And you find him almost listing felt need by felt need, the Maslow chart. Among man's desire for the satisfaction of all these elements, there is the desire for his satisfaction of meaning. And this is religion. So Nida makes use of this as well. He will also be very critical of functionalism. He touches on it in a couple of his books. And yet, at the same time, I think there's one thing that that ties him in with functionalism, and that is his view of religion as a religion carrying a componential character. It's a component. Religion is not integrative for Nida. It's just one component among many. In fact, in his book Message and Mission on page 10, he rejects any view of religion as what he calls a cultural capstone, a kind of overarching worldview of the supernatural. And that, I think, is where I disagree with him pretty strongly. Now, in other words, there's a certain functionalism that he's buying. Now, this same refusal to see religion as an integrating response of the human heart, to some degree also, you'll find in the writing of Charles Craft of Fuller Seminary.
You say the refusal.
Yeah.
The refusal to see religion as what?
As an integrating sort of core response of the human heart. On page, Kraft goes into this whole question a great deal in his book Christianity and Culture, and I don't really want to caricature him, but at the same time I do think that he shares many of these ideas in common with functionalism. He calls culture essentially neutral. It is basically, he says, a vehicle or milieu, neutral in essence, though it manifests in practice the pervasive influence of human sinfulness. He even uses the Melanowski chart in his book, attributes this to Melanowski, and speaks of religion as one more cultural function. Now, he does distinguish his view from Melanowski this way. Melanowski said, okay, here's all these horizontal kinds of functions, hunger, sex, need for community, religion, etc. And Chuck Kraft says, if I understand him right, okay, religion is one of these things, except it's the vertical element.
Then it is integrated, then.
No, he won't say that.
It cuts through, though.
It cuts through. It's vertical. Vertical, I think, more in the sense, Ian, it's tied in with God. You know, it's not mm-hmm. just a question, unlike all the other human needs. It's not a need that you fulfill in your relationship with another human being. This is a need, by contrast, which you can fulfill only in terms of of man's relationship to God. So in that sense, it's vertical. But it's not vertical in the sense that it integrates. It's still one more piece among many. And I guess this is one of the places where Chuck and I have the biggest differences. Because I think he still hasn't really... There's still a struggle here in terms of whether he really catches the significance of religion this way.
Reform world and life.
Well, you know, you hate to say this, Ian. I really do. But I guess I'd have to say that maybe this is the place where a reformed worldview does show up when it comes to how to understand religion. Because a reformed worldview is never content, to my mind, simply to say this is one, you know, this is one pigeonhole along with five or six other pigeonholes. It's got vastly more significance than just that. But the current trend in anthropology, you know, is never to see that. Our religion, if you do give it any credit, never has that integrative character to it. And that, to my mind, I think brings us to the last one I wanted to raise before you, and basically the position of Bobink and the one I'm most contented with, and that is this sort of idea of religion, if you want to call it anything else, call it the covenant definition. This would be element, I guess, four. The covenant definition of Bobink.
I have a question before
yeah.
that. You were talking about functionalism, rejecting the armchair way.
Yeah.
It sparked a question I wanted to ask earlier
sure.
regarding the structuralism. How does the structuralism do its research? Do they sit down and look at forms of literature and analyze? So that's basically
yeah.
an armchair type of
Well, thing? No, there'll be field work, for example, Tom, where they will go out and a lot of the myths, they spend a lot of time on a focus, at least up till now, on mythologies. So you have a lot of collection of myths and an attempt to understand their backgrounds, and then sort of a comparison of these things. Somewhere, Levi Strauss says, it's sort of like collecting myths is sort of like making a whole bunch of 3x5, transparent 3x5 cards. And on each card, you put, as it were, a myth, and you break it up into at least four components, because you see human myths in conflict all the time. A is to B as C is to D. So you break down all these components with myths. And then he says, if you could lay all these transparent 3x5 cards sort of on top of one another, and you could get down and look through them all, what you would likely see would be this tremendous pattern emerging as you're sort of looking down through all those cultures. And that Levi Strauss calls, you know, the difference between the synchronic and the diachronic point of view, where you don't sort of look across the surface, but you're looking down in depth through all these systems.
Now, the researcher obviously would have to work with many cultures that use strict oral tradition. So he's listening to something and recording it. Now, what about the process of listening and recording and that written document that's produced? How much of that you have to question? How much is that? Is the person who listened and interpreted what he heard?
Yeah.
I mean, it really gets sticky when you're working in that area.
And anthropologists are aware of that, mm-hmm. but it's always the struggle of, you know, how can you observe things carefully without intruding your own points of view?
Mm-hmm.
One of the great Christian linguists is a guy by the name of Kenneth Pike, whom some of you may know through Summer Institute of Linguistics, Wycliffe. Kenneth Pike created a distinction to try and handle that question. And it's very important in anthropology. Even secular anthropologists use it constantly. It's called the difference between the etic and the emic point of view. And he takes these terms from the word phonetic and phonemic. Phonetics is when you learn sort of systems of linguistics. These are sort of the rules, as it were, that you pick up first. The general systems, which then you apply towards a particular language group. That's phonetics. Sort of developing rules kind of from the outside. Phonemics is the system of how to break down a particular language group into its particular sounds and grammar. That's phonemic. Sort of looking at language from the inside out. And what Pike did was to drop that term phone and say, okay, in anthropology, in the study of human cultures, we have the phonetic point of view and the phonemic point of view. Up until now, most of our study has been the etic point of view. That is, outsiders come in with their already with their categories of how to study this system and look at it. But he says sometimes if you look at it from just this point of view, you miss a lot of things because your outsider point of view gets in the way. So he says we also have to develop a point of view in studying ethnologies from the inside. We just take the system as the person inside the system sees it. And we try not to impose any outsider point of view, but just to see it the way they see it. And we need both these points of view. Now, some of us, Kraft and others, and I guess I'd include myself here, are now saying we need to apply this to Christian theology. And we ask ourselves, isn't our problem and the inability of the church today to recognize the legitimacy of the third world doing theology?
Mm-hmm.
Is that up until now we have thought of systematic theology only from an etic point of view? Well, that's a universal given, isn't it? And so we take what we think are universal categories and then impose them into other cultures. And in the meantime, that means then that very often the Bible is not allowed to speak within a rich cultural heritage from in terms of the questions that that particular culture itself is facing. So some of us are saying, okay, let's not ditch systematic theology. We need the etic point of view, but we also need the emic too.
But systematic theology is also etic and emic. It's our emic.
Right, right.
It's our cultural orientation, our categories. The Westminster Confession of Faith is a cultural document, first and foremost.
Right, right. You got it. But our danger is...
Sorry for saying that.
Not yet.
Yeah.
But the danger of it, you know, here, Ian, with us, mm-hmm. is, you see, we don't recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
When we deal with something like, let's say, the Westminster Standards, most of our people are not sensitive to the fact that they also were emic documents
mm-hmm.
created to face a particular cultural setting, mm-hmm. you know, particular problems, theological questions in the 16th century.
Mm-hmm.
We have abstracted them. We have agnosticized them. We have taken the history out of them. And so suddenly they now appear before everybody as, well, this is God's truth.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, they were not, as a matter of fact. We have shifted the line, and suddenly they become etic. And so what people like Kraft, I think, and others of us are saying is, in terms of contextualizing theology, comes out here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep our, let's not discard the etic categories, but let's leave room to remember as well the place for people doing Christian emic theologizing.
So from the third world, you get things like doing theology in a revolutionary society.
Right, right, right. And I mean, a lot of us would say when we read that, boy, I don't agree with this theology. Etic or emic, it's not biblical. and yet at the same time, what we need to do is allow for enough leeway so people in other cultures can do that kind of thinking within that kind of context.
Well, the biggest problem with ethnic theology is that it's not being done by evangelicals.
Yeah, right, right.
But, a lot of times when you get the... Some of the folks, say, who do third world theology, what they, many of them trace their theology back to Europe anyway, to do a graduate study.
Yes,
they
right.
come back with kind of an avant-garde,
mm-hmm.
European, really, at heart, theology that
yeah.
isn't necessarily the worldview of their culture
yeah.
so much.
And it's directed to people who've been trained in European schools. I read a good article that said, if you really want to find out what's going on in the third world theologically, sit in the church pew on Sunday morning during Sunday school and find out what people are talking
yeah.
about, the issues and the problems, or even look at Christian education materials. You'll find you'll get a better barometer on what's going on in third world theology than you will on the guy who writes the book.
I would suggest too, Ian, so you could apply that here, working with oral cultures, listen to the music,
mm-hmm.
In the black church,
yeah.
the theology of the black church, you'll discern as you listen to the hymns. And not in terms of that's the place often where theology begins, you know, with the hymnody. That might make a very interesting study. But, you know, and you wonder, too, so many hymns are embedded into the Pauline literature, for example. People have said, you know, that's where some of the first places where some of the where the theology formed in the hymnody of the church. And Paul then simply is reflecting what already has been sort of percolating up from all the Lord's people. Some rich, really insightful things could come out of that. In the black church, I think probably the best thing I've seen so far doing that is by James Cone,
mm-hmm.
called The Spirituals and the Blues,
yeah.
where he really attempts to hear the spirituals as the emerging theology of the black church.
One of the contexts that I find myself in quite a bit, in fact, I have a meeting tonight with a suburban church to talk about this whole concept of urban and suburban partnerships,
mm-hmm.
urban ministry. And oftentimes suburban pastors will say to me, well, what can we really learn from an urban pastor? And one of the first things that I say is a process of doing theology.
Mm.
Because the urban pastor doesn't, his process of doing theology is sitting down with his Bible, poring over a text, trying to figure out what in the world can this mean to my people who are going through this problem and that problem. Automatically the categories are different, and therefore his context of doing theology is different. Therefore, his perspective is going to be different. Now, that right there is a valuable resource that a suburban pastor may not have, because his theology is often done by taking a book off the shelf. Is it trained at this school or that school? He's got his system already worked out.
Yeah.
He's got five verses already memorized to prove this thing, and
yeah.
he's lost the essence of doing theology, because now it's static. Theology is always moving, and it's always developing as we relate problems. The old idea of reading the Bible with the newspaper,
yeah,
and
yeah.
this kind of thing.
One of the scary parts in connection with this is the is very often with missionaries, because they often are placed in this the position of being a sort of a power broker in a culture, or just as in the North American culture, the white is the power broker. You leave with the Third World Church or with the Black Church the concept that they can't really do theology unless they do it in terms of our categories and our definitions. And so I find at CUTS some of the most exciting stuff happens in a class when the blacks in the class begin to realize that they don't have to come here to CUTS or anywhere else to learn theology, that they have, as a matter of fact, been doing it for decades. And just their catching that is always an exciting time. When they realize that their pulpit ministry is the doing of theology, that what their church is doing is theologizing. They don't have to operate out of our categories. But sometimes it's very difficult for them to see that, that what they really got is theology. I think even, maybe even here too, thinking of the functionalist model, though I would be critical of functionalism, I think we've got to recognize there's a real sense in which there's a healthy, positive thing to the idea of theology, or all of this as functional. In other words, if there's anything I hear from some of our discussion just now, it's that theology is not just sort of something that's passed on to you, but theology moves out of the people of God as they live in a given setting, facing a given set of problems, and then they function in that setting. And that's functional. But that's sure got to be part of how we theologize, or it's nothing.
So I still don't know whether we should be translating Hodge in Uganda or not.
Well, if you don't know by now, brother, I'm not going to tell you. I would say get the Bible out first.
Yeah. Or you can translate anyhow, it's Latin.
That's right. You could give us a shortened version. Right. You could cut out all the Latin and French.
Shortened version, Burkhoff.
Oh dear, oh dear. Well, that's another course. maybe you can't help but, I guess, you know, tied in with this, there's a theology is missing, maybe one of the major problems we've got with theologizing now in North America is it has lost its functional character, so that all we do in an institution like Westminster is memorize somebody else's, whether it be Hodge or Warfield. And it may be very good theology, and it may be really necessary for us to get it in order to maintain that continuity. After all, we do need the Attic point of view.
Yeah.
We're not saying one over against the other. But in the process, what gets lost, to my mind, is the missiological dimension of theologizing. You know, we do our theology without being deeply sensitive to the fact that we've got an unsaved world out there, and an unsaved world in which we should be constantly interacting. One of the things that I guess really excites me as I read, you know, so much third world theology is that there is very, it's hard to distinguish, you know, between what we call missions and what people in Nigeria or Korea or India call theology. Because all the theological discussions are carried on, you know, constantly in dialogue with these non-Christian religions. The great theologians of India are people whose theologies have been constructed as they've tried to present Christianity over against Hinduism. Or in Korea, for example, in the 1960s, we had a very fruitful time of theological work when we discussed the whole question of indigenization, or what we call Tochakwa. And all of that theologizing that went on there was almost like reading missions literature. because it was the Korean church or the Korean theologians interacting with shamanism, with Buddhism, with animism, with their religious systems in a theological dialogue which was basically missiological. And I think that happens any time down the line, and that's when you get exciting theology.
I think also the whole dynamic of holistic perception is important and significant. That you see coming out of third world theology that also relates very directly to mission. We say even the liberationists, but especially the liberationists, that they deal with the specific hurts of people from a bit different perspective than we, but nevertheless the categories that they choose define missions in a very strict sense.
Yeah.
And we need to learn at least the categories from them and at least understand them and then go back from our framework, beginning with the scripture rather than a socio-political philosophy and develop theology for it.
Yeah, I think that's very useful. And that surely is something we can learn from these functional definitions. Something which can really deeply enrich our whole understanding of where it's all going. I guess that's why I find as well that even when I have to interact with people like Kraft and Nida, I want to do it in as general a way as possible, though I have some big differences with how Kraft formulates his view of Scripture and other elements. Nevertheless, I find myself being very wary that with a lot of other evangelicals, I'm going to end up tossing out the baby with the bathwater and being so repelled by things that I don't like that I'll also turn away improperly from all the benefits and blessings that are there to mine. And that, I think, is particularly a danger we face in the contemporary setting. I see that, for example, in the Korean discussions in the 1960s of indigenization. I think Korea led the way in the 1960s, 20 years or 10 years, 10 to 20 years before the rest of the world had discovered the word contextualization. The Korean church was talking about contextualization. I think Korea led the way in that whole history. But unfortunately, because no one else knows the language, you know, all of that rich discussion will forever be embedded there in the Korean language until somebody uncovers it and say, look, the Koreans have been thinking about this 10 years before we were. But what's sad about it all is that all of the discussion was carried on within largely liberal circles. And evangelicals, appalled by the usage of Bultmann, Tillich, and these others who were in the discussion, Bart, immediately said, well, we'll have nothing to do with any discussions of indigenization. In some sense, properly fearful that the gospel would be lost in all this, they wanted to defend the gospel. But in the process, the evangelical missed the mark in Korea, I think. And as a result, even today, any discussions of contextualization, even from a biblical point of view, make the evangelical fearful.
In this talk itself, we use the word indigenization and contextualization. What is the difference, and where does one stop and the other begin?
Boy,
That's another course.
Oh dear. Oh, I hesitate to go into that one, Paulus. Let me suggest to you a good summary. One I would feel very comfortable with is in the book The Gospel and Islam, edited by Don McCurry. And in that book, there is a chapter by Charles Taber, T-A-B-E-R, called Indigenization, or called Indigenization/Contextualization. And in that essay, he lists six or seven areas of difference between the two points. And I would find myself very much in agreement with what he says.
Don McCurry, who published that?
Mark. But that might help you there.
Who is the editor of this?
Don McCurry. That's a very good essay.
Do you think this, like what happened in Korea, the same thing is happening in Latin America with liberation theology?
Could be.
Evangelical, we don't want any part of it.
Could be. I don't know enough about Latin America to judge, Tom, but I sense that there is a holding back, and there's a lot of tension even within the evangelical community about how these things should be perceived and judged.
I think that explains, if I can use names, I think it explains some of the conflict that Costas is feeling in the Hispanic community in Philadelphia, because he uses the terminology, thinks in process. Many of the conservative Hispanic pastors want nothing to do with him. He's a liberationist as far as they're concerned. They don't want to listen to him and his method. And it's a shame.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, I think there's much truth there.
Yeah.
The
what is the title of that book?
The Gospel and Islam. It was published in 1979. Just quickly then.
I've got a half hour for the answer.
Okay, half an hour. Oh, I need 5 minutes. Just read Boving.
That didn't take 5 minutes.
Well, I'll just amplify it. Boving sees religion as the radical heart of culture. In other words, religion is not simply an answer to a human need, as in functionalism. Religion is the human response to the revelation of God. It is not simply a human characteristic, either beneficial, as with Eliade, or a disease, as with Freud. It is the totalitarian, radical response of mankind in covenant to the revelation of God.
What chapter is this discussion?
Most of this comes more, I'm drawing more from his earlier book, Introduction to the Science of Missions. And you'll find a lot of this also, Ian, in his that book I referred you to the other day, The Impact of Christianity on the Non-Christian World.
Is that still in print?
No. But it's, if you can get a copy of it, it's well worth getting. But then he goes into how you define religion.
It is totalitarian,
right? Well, this is my language,
yeah.
But the totalitarian, radical response of man in covenant to the revelation of God. In other words, it's totalitarian, we mean, you know, it covers everything. It's not just one little segment of our life. It's radical in the sense that it goes right down to the core kind of thing. This is Boving's language. Religions are not simply complex entities containing much that is beneficial. They are powerful, life-controlling entities. Completely indivisible structures. Each element cohering with the other, receiving its meaning from the total structure. Now, there's a lot of language here that, you know, you're getting the whole impression of a whole picture. Some of this I don't agree with, but at least for the time being, I think there are a lot of things here we want to affirm. So in other words, in Boving's eyes, religion is a lot more than just a communication model, the way Nida argues. Religion is a response to the supercultural God. Supracultural, God above culture, like supernatural. I think a lot of you, I'm going to skip, there's a lot of biblical theology here. I think you can add your own biblical theology, you know, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and Genesis 4 is good, throw some of that in, okay?
they read the Bible.
Yeah, right.
You get a feel for it.
But I guess, you know, this the whole, again, I guess probably this is where it's so hard for me to work out of anything except a Reformed point of view. The Reformed Church has worked so much with the concept of human culture. Now, the defect of it, say with Burke, with Kuyper and others, is it's monocultural. You know, the only, when Kuyper talked about culture, he meant music, art, and that sort of thing. nobody outside of J.H. Bobbing in the Reform circles has worked with these kinds of ways of understanding culture. I think you get a lot of benefit out of Kuyper and that kind of study, but remember, it's very limited. But there are things we can buy here. Now, religion, according to this dimension, then, or this definition, has cultural or ethnic dimensions. But it is not one function of culture among many. That's important. Bobbing says, culture is religion made visible. Here's another Bobbing definition. Culture is that, and you almost can't separate what is culture from what is religion. Culture is that complex of sacred, moral, technical, agricultural forces. We're in a tribe or a people, tries to express its basic feelings towards God, towards nature, and towards itself. You know, it's a very comprehensive kind of thing. And a lot of, you know, is it from Toronto, the Institute of Christian Studies, and someplace, I think, in one of their documents, they say something about all of life is religion. I think that's coming from here, and I'm comfortable with that. I really am.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 1:30 or something, whether you eat or drink.
Yeah, right. 1 Corinthians 10, I think, is. Yeah. In, you know, it's that, and that's just part of what we've said, I think, for a long time, only struggling to try and make it fit into this set of definitions. For whether you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do it all to the glory of God. Here are all of these cultural things, eating, drinking, and anything else that's left over, and all of these can be done to the glory of God, or not. So the culture of a people is in its common attitude of life, its style of living and thinking, and all of this rooted in the way it sees reality. And that way of seeing reality is always religious. Here's my diagram, my contribution to human culture, which you can promptly forget. But maybe it'll. I don't like this the more I use it, but anyway.
Are these conograms? Is that what you call these?
Oh, dear.
One of these days you like to put Mickey Mouse up there.
Yeah. There's a little doivert in this, okay? But, you know, here's the religious dimension, the heart, whatever you want to call it, and then. Here are all these, on the outer edge of a culture are the customs, you know, eating with your fingers, eating with chopsticks, eating with knife, fork, or spoon, eating babies, eating monkeys, eating Cheerios.
Categories are marvelous.
When you move into a culture, it all begins here with the heart. You know, there's where the religion flows out of. And then out of this religion flows all of these different dimensions, all these different ways of putting your world together. These are the worldview dimensions. You know, Dogger says there's 14 of them. 14 ways to put your world together. Whether you buy all 14, whether you buy none of them, I don't really care. I'm not even sure I care about Doiberg, but the one thing I like about it is that it at least gives you a sort of a systematic way of seeing how it comes together. And maybe you could almost better look at this if you sort of put this up on end, something like that. Maybe it would sort of look like this. You know, here's the heart here, and things keep coming out like that. And right. A little louder for the mic. So what you've got on the edge, you know, are the simple external things that you see. And as you go deeper in, you know, you see other things too. They're all tied together. And yet also they can also be separated. They're discrete elements. You know, it's the one thing I don't like in Bobby's definition is that he makes it all such a neat package that there's almost no room in his way of thinking for pulling things apart, for seeing things as separate, you know, isolatable. Whereas in human cultures, they all don't just fit together. It's not like who was it? Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote that poem about the one horse shay, which was an attack on Calvinism, and this one horse shay was held together. You know, everything all marvelously unified, and then the poem ends with the whole thing suddenly collapsing. You know, one part goes, everything goes, and I sometimes think Bobbing moves a little bit in that kind of direction. That previous language I quoted to you makes it sound almost as if it's too much of an integrated kind of system. There's no room for give and take. But at any rate, it does help to see things better. For example, one of the big discussions in terms of religion is Confucianism a religion? For example, is Theravada Buddhism a religion? There are, as you know, two forms of Buddhism. There is the Buddhism of the major wheel and the Buddhism of the minor wheel. Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism is the Buddhism that pretty much circles the globe today. It's the Buddhism you'll find in Japan, Korea, so many parts of Asia. However, if you go to Sri Lanka and Ceylon, you will find still Theravada Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism basically does not believe in the existence of a personal God. That was an element added later, a concept of deity. All right, can you have a religion without any concept of deity? And that's a major discussion among many scholars of religion. What about Confucianism? Is Confucianism a religion? Most scholars, I think, in Asia would say, of course not. Confucius was totally agnostic when it came to whether there is a heaven or spirits. He said, don't bother me with those kinds of questions. Well, then how can you call Confucianism a religion when it says we are going to be agnostic about the world of the spirits? Most of the time when I've taught in Korea and I've raised that question, I've said, is Confucianism a religion? Most of the students in Korea say, well, of course not. My answer is, of course it is. Or at least, of course it has religious elements. Why? Because that's who we are. Anything you do that flows out of the heart has a religious commitment to it. And you cannot just simply put Confucianism aside as only a philosophy, not be a Calvinist. Simply because of the whole total dimension picture that you want to see in terms of all of life. Now, Hendrik Kramer, for example, calls Theravada Buddhism a non-theistic ethical discipline. Buddha, for example, never asked for prayer, never asked for praise. Buddha offered neither redemption nor forgiveness nor heaven. Buddha warned of no judgment, spoke of no final hell. And yet you'll go to a temple in Japan, Taiwan, Korea. You'll find a temple filled in Taiwan and Taipei with pictures of hell. There's one temple we visited with 14 different hells in it. Hell of ice, hell of fire, hell of judgment. One where everybody's getting poked with flaming sticks. But there's no concept of hell in Theravada Buddhism. Never even mentioned. Well, how on earth did it get there? Buddha, for example, refused to speculate on ultimate reality or any first cause. He was silent regarding the future life. When he died, And he was asked about these things. His last recorded words to his disciples were, "Look to yourselves," and then he died. Now, and all of this, he very strongly shares with Confucianism. Now, is this a religion? Early anthropologists, I think, would have said no to that question on the basis of their definition of religion. Because in these early definitions we've studied, religion was defined in terms of belief in supernatural beings, supernatural events. Therefore, this could not have been a religion. And in this sense, religion stood over against science. That was the argument of Malinowski. Other naturalistic explanations of the worldview, etc. Now, some contemporary anthropologists at least recognize that these kinds of distinctions are part of the Western world's separation of the sacred from the secular. And on the basis of that, I think we have to reinvestigate. Is Confucianism a religion or isn't it? A Korean, this I find this very interesting. Koreans, the evangelicals, see if I'm correct, Mr. Chung. Koreans ordinarily would argue that Confucianism is not a religion. And yet, on the anniversary of the memorial of the death of the ancestor, the ancestors are venerated. Is that a religious act? Sure it is. Well, how can you have a religious act coming from a non-religious system? You can't. So something's got to go. Either you change your definition of ancestor worship or you change your definition of Confucianism.
Do the Christians also do things?
No. But what I'm frustrated as I think it through, because I think the evangelicals I've talked to tend not to want to believe Confucianism is a religious system. And I'm arguing on the basis, you see, of this definition of religion that it is.
What then is the difference between philosophy and religion? Are they one and the same?
No, I don't think so. But I think, I guess I would be fairly comfortable with the fact that philosophy has got a sort of a wider purview to it, Ian. And it's more a science that covers the wider field than religion does. Here I'd be very comfortable with, generally with Dooyeweerd and how he defined the difference between religion and philosophy. But I'll leave that one up to you guys.
Wouldn't any of these customs, wouldn't one of these 14 spheres be philosophy?
Well, I think what Dooyeweerd argues is that what he calls immanence philosophy, sort of humanist philosophy, always sort of takes one of these kind of spokes of the wheel, pulls it out, and overblows it, so that it makes this overblown thing the thing that pulls everything together. Sometimes it can be the reason, rationalism, can be anything. And in that sense, I think I would say, okay, anytime you do that, you are engaging in a religious activity because you're creating an idol instead of God. You're not recognizing that it's the Lord that puts all this together, the Lord that holds it together. Instead, you're creating, using the creation to make your own God. That's how I see it. But.
One more question about Dooyeweerd. Is he influenced by structuralism?
No. It's he did most of his work long before structuralism came up. Anyway, I find Bavinck very helpful in trying to answer those kinds of questions, of Bavinck's definition, because he sort of broadens this idea of religion by seeing it as an integrating kind of thing. And its response, you know, that's something I think we've seen so many times before. It's like Paul says in Romans 1, Paul recognizes that our religions are responses. They're human responses, but they are responses to the revelation of God. And they will reflect, therefore, all the complexity, the psychological complexity, the human complexity of how we respond to God. So you're going to find in it reflections of our acknowledgement of God. And you'll find in it also reflections of our rebellion against God. And they're all mixed in together. So you can find glorious pieces, and like Bavinck says, and they're embedded in some of the most vile forms of language that, imaginable. And suddenly you see them both together. How do you explain that? Well, I think virtually the only way you can is to grab some hold of religion as, you know, it's here's man's covenant response to the revelation of God. Now, all of this, any anthropologist will throw his hands up in horror at and jump out that window, because it assumes, one, there is an authentic, real revelation of God, and it assumes that that we got it, that it managed to filter down through all the fog and the smog of our rebellion, and we really got it. And then it assumes also that after we got it, we said, I don't want it. And any of these kinds of, at any of these points along the way, the anthropologist will say, never, never. Because it assumes, you know, the givenness of a revelation of God. And it assumes that the human heart is in rebellion against God and is responding to that revelation of God. That, I think, is, again, what makes Bobbing so very exciting, because he tries to see that. Further, I think also, we may not get into this in the course, it also means that religion is more than just sort of how to deal with the, quote, supernatural. In this sense, religion may or may not deal with the gods, with demons, and with the human soul. In the sense of Bobbing, Marxism is a religion. In Bobbing's sense, capitalism is a religion. In Bobbing's sense, racism is a religion. I guess what I'm struggling for is a definition of religion that is loose enough or free enough around the edges so that I can try to see that no matter what kind of philosophy I create or what kind of ideology I play around with, if that philosophy or that ideology or whatever else becomes something of ultimate meaning to me, and that's Tillich's language, but if it becomes so ultimate to me, it becomes the thing around which I structure all of my life and put together how I understand the world, that's religion.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that help any?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what I was driving at before.
Okay.
So if you take your philosophy seriously, then you've taken that leap into religion.
Right, right. And if I think what this enables you to do then is especially to handle Marxism. And and to deal with the whole question of ideologies. One of the things that Bobbing does not touch at all is in this area. And yet, if we're going to deal with eclectics in the city, these are crucial questions. Particularly the Latin American context, but also, for example, the whole question of racism in the United States. We are dealing with a religious issue, with a religious ideology. Because it so grips people, it can't break them loose.
But then can one be adherent of more than one religion at the same time?
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. You know, it's sort of like, the Chinese, of which you, it's been said, you know, they are born, the Chinese are born as Confucianists, marry as Taoists, and they die as Buddhists. So you're able to put them all together.
So a capitalist could very easily be a racist, and if he's in the South, he'd have a little Bible Belt into it.
Yeah, sure.
Have a little mixture of the three.
Sure, and he could live in Chicago and do the same.
Yeah.
This past weekend, they just finished the mayoral primaries in Chicago, and I arrived the day after the election, which for the first, if you're Democrat, the last time I think they had a Republican mayor in Chicago, somebody said, was in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And so whoever wins the Democratic primary virtually wins the mayoralty. Well, they had three people running this year. One was Jane Byrne, the former mayor, and the son of Daley, what's his name?
Richard
Daley Jr., and then a black, Harold Washington. And Daley and Byrne split the white vote, and Washington won the election. And I sat at the dinner table listening to some of the conversation, and I arrived Friday night in a suburban Wheaton town, and it was really something. I just... Oh, boy.
Did you wear your Wilson Good sticker?
Yes. I had some good sermon illustrations that night, I'll tell you. But in the Chicago Tribune for that day, there was the editorial cartoon. And, you know, Chicago is heavily Democratic, you know. The and these two workers were talking together about the election. And one worker was saying to the other, I'm not bigoted, I'm not biased, I'm not racist, I'm not any of those blankety-blank things, but I'll be doggone if I'm going to blankety-blank vote for a Republican. built into that all kinds of double entendre. But, oh, dear me, scary.
I wanted to share an example from the news last night. There was a thing on a tennis player who is very good, but he said, I'm not putting tennis first in my life. I don't know his religion, but he goes, God is first, my family, and then tennis is like a profession, not a... And he was being very sharply criticized by other tennis players that you've got to put, it's got to be everything or else you won't be number one. And it's just interesting that, you know, it's likely going to be a central controlling thing, you know, but his profession, not his life.
Yeah. I think, Mark, here's where Tillich, you know, for all the stuff we've got, his concept here of ultimate concern, that can be helpful. You know, is tennis can be so much your ultimate concern, that becomes your God. And what's missing, of course, in Tillich is, you know, that the real God is not just ultimate concern or being with a capital B, but it's, you know, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. But still, that helps you. That helps you get some sense of what's, of how you see these worlds sort of sweeping around you. Norm?
When you go then to someone else who's not a Christian, do you say to him, we have the true religion or we have the only religion?
I'm not sure I would say either. You know, I'm sure I would believe both. But the question becomes, and that doesn't seem to me to be the most profitable way to begin an evangelistic conversation with a Muslim.
No, I'm not talking about method of evangelism.
Okay.
I'm talking about what you go to him with and how you basically in your heart approach that other religion.
Right.
Is it a question of truth versus falseness, or is it a question...
Sure.
Or is it a question of here is religion, true and undefiled religion, so to speak.
Okay.
And so the other things are sort of spin-offs.
Yeah.
I guess I had a philosophy teacher in college who discussed this, and he ended up by saying that the only thing you could legitimately call a religion was Christianity.
That's
where he ended up. So Lloyd Dean, I don't know if you know him from Rhode Island. That's what he ended up by saying. And I think he worked with this kind of a model that you're working with right here.
My problem with that, Norm, is that that sounds a little bit like Karl Barth, who makes a very radical difference between revelation and religions, and who very strongly puts down any kind of religious systems as nothing. I don't buy that, and I think that part of it is because our confidence in the biblical doctrine of general revelation and common grace, as it were, that can't simply, you know, force us to that allows us to say Christianity is the only and true religion. But it also allows us to say, I can at the same time see the footprints of the Lord left over in the paths of all of these other religious systems. And it allows us also to say, I see in the Christendom that too often I have defined simply as what the Bible teaches, leftovers of the footprints of Satan too. And I think constantly we've got to interact that way with other religious systems. That would leave me just a little bit scary, that kind of... kind of approach to it.